Our first passage is from Mark chapter 1, beginning at verse 35 and reading through to verse 39. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him, and when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I have come." So he travelled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. And the second passage is from Mark's Gospel, chapter 6, and we're beginning at verse 30 and reading through to verse 46. It's interesting, at the beginning of this, the disciples have just come back from a big mission. Jesus has sent them out earlier in the Gospel. And it's interesting that at the beginning of that passage, they're called disciples, which is a student, a learner. As we begin this passage, it starts off apostles. And apostles, as you know, are people that are sent out. They're missionaries. So they've just come back from this big mission and they're called apostles. And then later on in the passage that we're reading, they are then again called disciples. Just something that struck me. So we begin at Mark chapter 6, verse 30. The apostles gathered round Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. Then, because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, he said to them, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest." So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. By this time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. "This is a remote place," they said, "and it's already very late. Send the people away so they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "That would take more than half a year's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat?" "How many loaves do you have?" he asked. "Go and see." When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them all. So they all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. The number of the men who had eaten was 5,000. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray.
Thank you to everyone who's been leading us in worship this morning. We are currently following a sermon series that's entitled To Be Like Jesus. And today we're going to consider the idea of Jesus the ascetic. Now, in this series, everything begins with A, and so I might occasionally use words that we may not immediately think, oh, I'm not sure what that means. So we use artisan to start off with, and I gave a definition. And just in case we're not sure what an ascetic is, the Collins Dictionary says it's a person who practices great self-denial and abstains from worldly comforts and pleasures, especially for religious reasons. So I don't know what your gut reaction is to that. Think about, well, I'll keep away from those type of people. And I certainly wouldn't want to be one of those people because I don't want to be involved in self-denial. And I quite like the worldly comforts and pleasures. Thank you very much. Well, I want us to take a look and see how, in many ways, Jesus showed many of the characteristics of the ascetic. And one of those areas, as it says here, is to do with self-denial and self-discipline and sacrifice. And we see that right at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry when he goes into the wilderness and for 40 days he is fasting, self-denial of food, and resisting the temptation of the enemy, of the devil. And then when he comes out through his ministry over 3 years, he's often tempted and tested by religious leaders who try and trap him and tempt him to be able to say things that they can trick him with, and he responds out of grace and wisdom and a massive amount of patience. Jesus said, in regard to his life, he said, "My food," in John 4:34, "my food," said Jesus, "is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work." In his divinity, Jesus was the Son of God, but in his humanity, Jesus was the perfect human, the perfect example of what it is to live the human life. And he dedicated himself to put aside his own desires and his plans for himself in his humanity and to live fully in seeking to fulfill the plans and the purposes of his heavenly Father, calling them his food. He was used to fasting, and he's saying that actually to follow the Father's will is my food. And we'll talk a little bit about that again in a minute. Another characteristic of the ascetic life is simplicity. Living an uncluttered life, freeing ourselves from excessive material possessions or luxuries. And if I'm absolutely honest, this has been an area that I've struggled with over many years. I've always been, since I was very young, a gadget freak. And I've always tended to try and surround myself with this little trinket or this little, not kind of an ornament, but something to play with or something to use. And when I discovered eBay, of course, that was a terrible place to be able to put around yourself because you find all kinds of things there that you think you need. And then you go and buy them and then you put them away in a box in the loft or in the garage and you hardly ever use them again. And then you go on the hunt for something else you think you need. And before you know, you've accumulated so much stuff. And I've had to work hard in my life to try and resist this. So I don't tune in, for example, when the gadget show used to be on Channel 5. That to me would have been the absolute go-to thing. I've said, I can't go to that. And I resist the idea on to going to like, I want one of those .com websites, which is because you see something, you say, well, I do want one of those. You didn't before you went on the site, but then when you see it, you want one because you see. And I know that this is something I struggle with or have struggled with, and I've had to discipline myself. Now I'm very boring. So when my birthday comes along and my family say, what can we get you? I say, oh, I don't want anything. I don't need anything. And I've managed through prayer and self-discipline to try and resist. I still, don't get me wrong, if you offer me a gadget, I'll be quite happy to receive it. But it's the resisting this temptation to be kind of surrounded and try and live as best as possible the simple life. But if you looked at my garage right now, you'll know that I'm not doing exceedingly well on this. But Jesus didn't live in luxury. We see that right at the very beginning. He was laid into a manger. In some kind of place where the animals were, rather than being born into a palace surrounded by wealth and privilege. And in our first reading today, Jesus is in a house, and it's not his house. In fact, even though there was a family home in Nazareth, Jesus never owned a house. And we all know with our houses just how much time and resources we plow into our house. We want to make our house look nice, and we fill it with stuff that helps us to enjoy being in our house and be entertained in our house. A lot of time and money and effort is placed into our houses. And if we're not careful, our house can actually be a distraction from other things that might be very important in God's eyes, including doing his plans and purpose. Well, Jesus actually resisted the temptations of that by never, ever having a house. He lived a very simple life. He lived in other people's houses. And he didn't sort of store loads of his own stuff. He tended to just have the needs for the day being met. In fact, one time, a teacher of the law followed Jesus and said, "I'll follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said this, Matthew 8, Jesus replied, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." That doesn't mean that Jesus never slept. You know, he never rested. It means that he didn't have one place that he called home. I don't think he's against the idea of it. But just in Jesus' desire to live the simple life as an ascetic, he didn't have one specific home, but relied upon the hospitality of others to be able to open their houses to him and to his disciples. As an ascetic, he didn't own very much. In fact, Jesus tended to borrow quite a few things. If you read the scriptures, he borrowed the manger to be laid in, although he didn't personally do that, but he was in something and laid in something he didn't own. And as I said about the houses, he also borrowed Peter's boat to preach in. And it was probably Peter's boat that he used to sail around. He didn't use somebody commercial to hire to do that. When Jesus was tested about paying taxes, he didn't pull out a coin from his own robe. He asked for somebody else to give him a coin. He borrowed somebody's coin. Well, we read about the feeding of the 5,000. Well, he borrowed a boy's lunch for that. He didn't actually borrow, he actually used it all. Probably gave the boy back more than he started with, of course, because they had 12 baskets full at the end of it, which was more than they started with. Amazing. He borrowed a donkey to ride into Jerusalem when they all shouted Hosanna that we sang about earlier on. He borrowed a room to hold the Last Supper in. He even borrowed, albeit temporarily, a tomb owned by Joseph of Arimathea when he died. So Jesus lived the simple life. He wasn't surrounded by the accumulation of material wealth. There's one other thing which I want to mention this morning about the idea of the ascetic life. Simplicity, self-denial, sacrifice. But another thing is solitude. And another definition from the Cambridge Dictionary of Solitude: the situation of being alone, often by choice. Now, if you're someone who loves to be surrounded by people, you get your energy that way, then the idea of seeking after solitude would be something you want to avoid. I don't want to be on my own. I love people. I love being with people. I'm an extrovert. I get that real buzz with other people. If, however, you're always around people, you might crave for just a little bit of time on your own. And if you're an introvert, you very much like to be on your own. For some of us, solitude is something we experience every day because we live on our own. And that might be a good thing in your mind, or it might be a very sad and bad thing. Some people, like monks and nuns and nomads and adventurers, they intentionally choose to go away from people for a set period of time to go on their adventures and as part perhaps of their spiritual awakening and journey. When we look at the life of Jesus, he sought after places of solitude, but he wasn't trying to get away from people. He actually was needing to spend time to prepare himself to engage with people. So as I mentioned, in Mark 1, Jesus is in a house. We probably think it's Peter's house. Jesus had healed his mother-in-law. And then it says that in the same evening, loads of people turned up at the door and Jesus is healing and delivering people. It was quite a major life group that evening when everybody was there. And at the end of it all, I'm sure Jesus was physically, in his humanity, was exhausted, and they all went to sleep in the house. And probably there were some people perhaps outside the door who also slept because they hadn't had their healing yet. So they were there already for the next day when it could be part two of Jesus' healing campaign, and I'll get my healing. And it says that early in the morning, Jesus awoke and chose to spend some time in prayer. I don't know about you. I don't know if you, when you wake up, if you think about praying, do you then pray in your bed? with the risk that next thing you know, you've slept for another half an hour and you don't remember praying at all? Or do you get up? Do you have a place, you know, you can get up and pray? Well, it seems that what Jesus did is he got up and he left the building. And he chose to go very early in the morning when it was dark. And it says in Mark 1:35, very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. That word solitary is the same word that's often translated in the scriptures as wilderness. The King James translates it as the desert place. So Jesus intentionally went to an uninhabited place so that he could pray without being distracted by anything or anyone. Now, those of us who are larks, you might think, well, actually getting up early in the morning, simple, I do it every day. It's not too much of a strain if you had to add prayer to that. But those of you who are owls, you may find it a little bit difficult or very difficult to have to sort of get up very early when you're actually a night bird. But maybe that's part of the discipline of the ascetic lifestyle. Is it's meant to be hard. There's meant to be some sacrifice involved in doing some of these things in our relationship with God. I would describe myself as an owl. I much prefer the nighttime than early mornings. In fact, I find it a strain to do anything very early in the morning. But I think I've mentioned before that I do remember one experience once where when I was in Birkenhead, a small group of men, and I joined very early. I don't know if it was very early, but I always felt it was very early. We met in a cricket pavilion in Birkenhead School because one of the men in our group was the caretaker at the school, so he opened up for us. And so we would sometimes, in the dark, we'd arrive in this very worn-out cricket pavilion, and we chose to pray very early in the morning on a Saturday morning. And we chose mainly the way we would pray is just pray for people as they came into our mind, people we haven't seen for a while. Let's just pray for them. And time again, the people that came to our mind and we prayed for, we would see in church the next day or we'd bump into in the streets. It was almost as if there would come in kind of a divine calling together. We had prayed for them, and then suddenly, for the first time in weeks and weeks, we would see them in very shortly afterwards. It was a very fruitful ministry, but boy, was it hard to get up really early in the morning to be able to go and do that. Certainly it was hard for me. I don't think it was so much for the other guys, but it was for me. Now, whilst I think this idea of finding a place of solitude to pray is a very good thing to be able to emulate, I'm not sure that because Jesus did it very early in the morning, that means we've all got to get up very early in the morning if we want to be like Jesus. I think he'd be quite happy if we had a midnight prayer meeting or a mid-afternoon prayer meeting. I don't think the time is important. It's the discipline of spending time in prayer, I think, is an interesting thing for us to think about if we want to be like Jesus. And I'll mention just a tiny bit more about that in just a moment before I close. We don't know how long Jesus was in this solitary place before the other disciples woke up. But when they woke up, they saw Jesus gone. Perhaps they started to panic a little bit. They went on the hunt for him, and then they find him in his solitary place. And this is what they say when they find him. Simon and his companions went to look for him, and when they found him, they explained, "Everyone is looking for you." So everyone's now woken up, everyone in the house, maybe people outside the house. "Where's Jesus? Where's Jesus?" So they go and find him. And their thought was, "We'll bring him back to the house and then he can start again part two of his healing campaign." But Jesus says this in response. Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I've come." So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. I'm sure many of the people who were back at the house were a bit disappointed that Jesus hadn't come back, but actually perhaps followed him to the next village to try and get their healing. Jesus had gone away to pray in solitude, not to get away from people, but to be empowered, to be refreshed, to get ready to engage with even more people in other places, because that is why he had come, he said. He wanted to engage in an intimate and consistent loving relationship with his Heavenly Father, but also to be refreshed and inspired and equipped and empowered to go out and serve the people that he'd been sent into the world to serve. And I think that's a good thing to think about when we come to the Lord in prayer. There can be the temptation for us to spend a lot of time in prayer asking God for what we want, for what we need. Maybe to add to our accumulation of stuff. Lord, I really need this. I really need that. And that's not wrong, because Jesus did teach the disciples to ask God for the daily needs. But also to remember that when we gather in God's presence to pray, it's also to ask the Lord to refresh us and equip us to be able to be of service to him by serving others. That's what Jesus did. He went away to pray so that he may be a blessing to others. We see that again in Luke chapter 6, when Jesus publicly chose 12 of his disciples and designated them apostles. It says, Jesus went out, this is in Luke 6, 12, Jesus went out to the mountainside to pray and spent the night praying to God. He did it in the nighttime. Yeah, I can identify with that. He went right through the night praying. When morning came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also designated apostles. So we've got here that Jesus' time of solitude all through the night in prayer was equipping him ready to make a really important decision, which was to choose from all of these hundreds of disciples that were following him at that point and choose 12 of them to appoint as apostles that he could train them up and then send them out. I think this is another good reminder when it comes to prayer. If we are making major decisions in our life, if we want to be like Jesus, it's a good practice to take ourselves aside from the crowd and spend some time in prayer, asking the Lord either to bless what we've already decided in our heart we're going to do and just affirm that our decisions are in line with his will and get that peace, or to ask God for guidance as to what that decision should be. So we get this feeding of the 5,000. I don't want to talk too much about that, but that fitted more in with last week's when we were thinking about Jesus, the great administrator. Jesus did brilliantly in order to be able to sort this crowd out. He delegated responsibility to the disciples to split them up into 50s and 100s. That's how you break down a big project. You break it down into small groups, good administration. He delegated his disciples to distribute the borrowed fish and bread, and then he delegated the disciples to collect them all up again so they could see this mighty miracle of having more than they started with. It's a fantastic mixture of excellent people management and supernatural provision. And what's interesting, though, is that particular evangelistic event wasn't planned. Jesus hadn't got up that morning and said, right, I'm going to preach all day, then we're going to multiply a lot of bread and fish, and then we're going to feed over 5,000 people, because that's just the number of men. This was a spontaneous event caused by the people. They had gathered around Jesus and they didn't want to leave. So Jesus felt compassion for them and wanted to feed them. So he fed them spiritually with teaching, and then he fed them physically with bread and fish. But I want us to note this morning what happened before and after that event, because Jesus had solitude on his mind. As Mac mentioned earlier on, the scene in Mark 6 is that Jesus has sent out the disciples on their short-term mission that we thought about last week, and now they've come back to report, and it says this. The apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. Then, because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, he said to them, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place. Get some rest." So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. Jesus saw the need for rest and for sustenance and some peace and quiet. And therefore, he intentionally led his disciples away from the crowd and desired to take them to a solitary place. That's the same word that's used in Mark chapter 1 that we saw, that Jesus went to a solitary place. Jesus knew personally that taking time aside to pray and be refreshed was extremely important if you're going to minister. So he packed his disciples into a boat and took them to what he expected to be a quiet and exclusive place for them to rest and re-energize. But what happened is the crowd spotted him and they started running along the shore ahead of them, so that by the time Jesus got to the point of, the disciples got a little bit of refreshment in the boat, a little bit of time out, but then when they got to the shore, it says, when Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, so he began teaching them many things. Jesus loved the disciples and wanted them to have a rest, but at that moment, he loved the people And he knew they had a need to be taught. And so he taught them. So the disciples didn't really get their refreshing rest. In fact, they got a job to do. They had to give out loads of bread and fish, and they had to collect it all back up again. But the amazing experience of that would have really excited them, seeing this dynamic miracle happen. But as soon as it finished, Jesus did this. Mark 6:45, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. So as soon as this spontaneous opportunity to be able to work a miracle had finished and they'd collected up all of the baskets, Jesus said, right, let's get back to what we were going to do at the start of this. It's downtime. Get in the boat and go ahead of me. We're going to go to Bethsaida next, but off you go. I'll sort out the dismissing of the crowd. You've done your job. Well done. Now go and rest. So they would have had some rest in the boat, although if we read later in chapter 6, a storm starts brewing on the boat, so they didn't really get the rest. But the intention was to go and have a rest while Jesus dismissed the crowd. Once he had done that, this is what Jesus did. After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray. So after ministering to the people, Jesus the ascetic went back to his place of solitude, up on the mountain to pray. He wasn't cutting himself off from people because he wasn't sociable, or nor because he didn't like people, or nor because he just simply liked his own company. Jesus put himself in the place of solitude after ministering to the people so he could refresh and reflect, recharge his battery, so to speak, to pray, ready to engage in the next phase of his ministry. In the end of Mark's gospel, he's back in Bethsaida and other villages ministering to them. That's how it ends. And this pattern that Jesus followed, prayer in solitude, followed by ministry, we see right to the very end of his life. So when we get to the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus, who's on the night he's betrayed, he goes into Gethsemane with Peter, James, and John, and then he leaves them on the outside, and he goes on his own into the Garden of Gethsemane to pray. And it says in Luke 22:42, Jesus prays, Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done. Jesus the ascetic, exercising extreme self-denial. If you're willing, take this away, but in the end, it's not about me. Let your will be done. Not mine, but yours. And that paved the way for the unrivaled act of sacrifice from Jesus in going to the cross. For this was the purpose in which Jesus came into this world, to be the one who would bear the punishment for our sin and produce the most intense moment of solitude that Jesus had ever experienced in his life. Not only did Jesus experience the excruciating pain of being abused by soldiers as they whipped him and pushed a crown of thorns into his head and nailed his hands and feet to the cross, not only did he endure all of that personal suffering, he also endured what perhaps may have been even worse, the moment that he caused him to cry out these words, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Sin cuts us off from God, and Jesus bore all of our sin on himself. So as he hung upon the cross, he experienced for the first time in his life the awful feeling of being separated from his heavenly Father. Why have you forsaken me? Jesus felt totally alone as he bore the sin of the world upon himself. And he did that for you and me, out of his love for us. So we can see that Jesus demonstrated ascetic life. But what about us? We always want to know, well, what about us? How is this meant to be for us? We can see this, what Jesus did, but what about us? Well, is this something that we should do as well? Or at least consider doing? I don't think we have to, but it might consider if we want to be like Jesus. Well, the German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he wrote in his book, The Cost of Discipleship, he said, if we do not have some element of the ascetic in us, we will find it hard to follow Jesus. Have some of the ascetic. in us. And I think what he had in mind was what Jesus said when he talked about the cost of discipleship. He said, if you want to follow me, he said in Mark 8, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Ascetics exercise self-denial. They gave up stuff. They abstain from stuff in order to better their lives. Jesus said, actually, you need to give up yourself if you're going to follow me. I'm going to take it further. Deny yourself. Take up your cross because it's going to be painful. And follow me. I think Jesus is there touching on the idea, are you willing to live the ascetic life when nothing is more important than following me? When it comes to simplicity, Jesus wrote quite a bit, spoke quite a bit about the dangers of accumulating too much stuff, and particularly against making money, for example, our gods. Here's a couple of examples from Luke 12 and 16. Jesus said, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. No one can serve two masters. Either you'll hate one or love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And Jesus, it says, said this to the Pharisees. It actually says, who loved money. Jesus told a parable in Luke 16 about the dangers of building bigger barns. You've got so much stuff, rather than give it all away and be generous. No, the man builds bigger barns, more stuff, bigger garage. After saying about denying yourself and follow me, Jesus said this in Mark 8:36. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? I don't think Jesus' teaching to all of his disciples was you've got to get rid of everything and then spend your life borrowing everything like I do. I don't think Jesus was saying that. But he did challenge a rich young ruler to sell everything he owned and give it to the poor and follow him. And I think that was because this young man devoted his life and surrounding himself with his accumulation of possessions, so much so that he loved them and couldn't think how he could possibly live without them. So when Jesus challenged him, do you really want to follow me? Okay, well, let go of all of those things that you put your hope and trust in, your affluent lifestyle. Put all of that away, get rid of it all, now come and follow me. And it says that the man went away sad because he was very wealthy. He wasn't prepared to give up all of the stuff. And Jesus may want to challenge us, not necessarily to sell up everything and give it all away and have nothing, but maybe to have a careful look at our own lives to see what we surround ourselves with, what we accumulate, what we perhaps allow to monopolize our thinking, we spend all of our time and our resources on, that might just pull us away from some of the time when the Lord says, but what about me? Don't have time for me, but you have time for that. Or you have time for this. Or you have time for the other. Will you put me first? What about finding a place of solitude as I close? Mentioned earlier, I'm not sure that Jesus meant that we have to get up very, very early in the morning. But I do think he encourages his followers to find a place of prayer. He said this, he was talking about warning them against the Pharisees who wanted to publicly pray in so everyone could see how pious they were. And Jesus said this in Matthew 6, when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites. That's talking about the Pharisees who were like actors wearing masks. For they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Truly I tell you, they've received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who's unseen. Then your Father who sees what's done in secret will reward you. Jesus encouraged his disciples to set aside a place where they can close the door, enter into a place of solitude, and pray. And it might be that we take a look at our lifestyles, which can be very, very, very busy. Even when we've retired, we can be very, very busy. If we find it difficult to find a place where we could be able to say, well, that's a place of solitude where I could pray because it's a very busy life, we can take something from the lesson of Charles and Wesley and John Wesley's mother. You may have, if you've ever looked into church history, quite often it's mentioned that Susanna Wesley as she brought up her boys, had a practice of setting aside a space of solitude for her prayer. And it was in a kitchen. And what she would do is she would get hold of her apron and she'd pull her apron over her head to spend some time in prayer. And John and Charles Wesley knew that where mummy's got is under her apron, she is not to be disturbed because she's having time with Jesus. She made space by creating her room under her apron. I wonder if we have a room, we have a place where we can experience some solitude. Maybe we'd go there to read a book. Maybe we'd go there to watch a film. But do we have a place of solitude we will go and pray, spend time with the Lord? Wherever or however we do it, it's nurturing a desire to pray that's important. John Mark Comer wrote in his book, Practicing the Way, he said this, about developing what he called the inner nun or the inner monk. He said, if we do not come to desire some kind of inner monk or nun, long uninterrupted times of quiet prayer, days of fasting, disciplines of abstinence from our culture's rampant, unbridled pursuit of pleasure, hedonism, and materialism, we simply will not make it very far on the spiritual path. He's not advocating isolating ourselves by going and moving into a monastery or a nunnery. But rather, as the theologian Jerome said, find in the busy city the desert of the monks. In other words, find a solitary place in the busyness of our lives where we can nurture an inner desire for real quality, undisturbed one-to-one time with the Lord. I want to encourage us as followers of Jesus this week to nurture our inner nun and our inner monk. To find in the busyness of our life a place of solitude where if we are having to make a decision, an important decision, we will in our lives that we will set aside time to bring this to the Lord in prayer. If we need to find physical refreshment this week, in our busy life, if we need to be prepared for some relationship that we need to develop with others, if we just want to enjoy the presence of the Lord, can I encourage you to find the time and then find a room or find a mountain or find an apron, find a solitary place in God's presence where there's no other distraction. And then we can maybe identify with what King David said this in Psalm 36, how priceless is your unfailing love of God. People take refuge in the shadow of your wings. They feast on the abundance of your house. You give them drink from your river of delights. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light we see light. May we experience that abundant house, that refreshing river, and that life-bringing fountain as we set a solitary time aside to draw near to him.